Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Tom Hayden, former California legislator, peace activist, and co-founder of Students for a Democratic Society, who assesses President Obama's recent address on the future course of the U.S. war in Afghanistan. Mazen Kumsia, a Palestinian-American living in the West Bank, who discusses the resurgence of nonviolent direct action in the Palestinian struggle against Israeli occupation and oppression. And Bob Edgar, president of Common Cause, who explains why his group has made a formal complaint to the IRS, charging that the corporate lobby organization ALEC has operated in violation of the U.S. tax code. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The European Union and the United Nations are calling on Cambodia to launch an independent inquiry into the murder of prominent anti-logging activist Chut Wudi, who died in a confrontation with a Cambodian soldier. Wudi, head of the Natural Resources Protection Group, was working with indigenous groups to stop illegal logging. Just before his death, he was taking pictures in a rainforest where a Chinese company was building a dam. Wudi, who was traveling with two Cambodian journalists, was shot on April 26th after he refused to give up his camera's digital memory stick. A leading Cambodian human rights group, the Center for Cambodian Civic Education, called the incident cold-blooded murder. Robert Colville, a spokesman for the UN High Commissioner of Refugees, noted, "The killing of Mr. Wudi marks the latest and most lethal in a series of gun attacks against human rights defenders in Cambodia." According to The Guardian, Wudi faced numerous death threats and often carried an AK-47 for his own protection. He has campaigned against illegal logging in that country since the late 1990s and played a vital role in supporting the Prey Long Network, a grassroots movement protecting rainforests in four provinces. According to Foreign Policy magazine, a new cottage industry has sprung up in Iran among Shiite clerics and fundamentalists-turned-amateur sexologists offering dubious advice on a variety of sexual topics. Clerical focus on sexual conduct can be traced back to Ayatollah Khomeini, the founder of the Islamic Revolution, whose 1961 religious treatise commented on illicit sexual acts from sodomy to bestiality. Current scholars of Shia Islam say Khomeini was typical of his generation of clerics seeking to navigate the divide between traditional and modern industrialized society. Today, despite religious proscriptions by the Islamic State, pornography is easily accessed on Iranian satellite television. The Islamic Revolution emerged in part from a strong clerical rejection of the rise of women during the days of modernization under the regime of Shah Pahlavi. After the 1979 revolution, clerics employed threats and intimidation to force women to wear veils. The harsh attitude toward women continues under current Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, who insists women must wear the hijab head covering to prevent society from being plunged into corruption and turmoil. Outside the General Electric shareholders' meeting in Detroit, over 2,000 people marched to shine a harsh light on GE for not paying federal income taxes for 3 years and for cutting wages of its American blue-collar workforce. Protesters came from throughout the Midwest to GE, uniting workers, Occupy activists, and environmentalists. At one point, marchers tried to enter the Renaissance Center where the shareholders' meeting was held, but were blocked by police on horseback. According to the publication Labor Notes, GE has for decades taken a hard line against unions by outsourcing jobs to non-union states and low-wage nations overseas. In 1969, GE employed 150,000 union workers in the U.S. By 2011, that number had fallen to 16,000 union workers, with 30 plants closing in the last 4 years. Worker anger at GE has been fueled by wage cuts at reopened GE factories. In West Burlington, Iowa, wages for returning workers were cut in half to $12 an hour, with meager retirement benefits. When workers have initiated recent unionization drives, GE has responded by attempting to thwart the campaigns using various tactics, including pitting older and younger workers against each other. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Richard Hill.
marking the one-year anniversary of his order that sent a U.S. Navy SEAL team into Pakistan, where they killed al-Qaeda leader Osama bin Laden, President Obama traveled in secrecy to Afghanistan on May 1st, where he addressed the nation about the Afghan war. In a speech televised live from a military hangar at the U.S. Bagram Air Base, the president outlined his plan to end the Afghan conflict, in his words, responsibly. Mr. Obama outlined the strategic partnership agreement he signed with Afghan President Karzai during the trip, which affirms that the U.S. and its allies will turn over security responsibilities to the Afghan government by the end of 2014. The agreement that will run through 2024 specifies two continuing roles for America's military: assistance with counterterrorism operations targeting al-Qaeda, and the training of Afghan soldiers and police. While some 80,000 U.S. soldiers are deployed in Afghanistan today, the president has not specified the number of troops that will remain in country after 2014. The newly elected president of France, François Hollande, pledged during his campaign to withdraw all French combat troops from Afghanistan by the end of 2012. A NATO meeting to be held in Chicago May 20th through 21st is expected to hammer out details of the coalition's Afghan commitment. Your reporter spoke with Tom Hayden, a former California state senator, veteran peace and civil rights organizer, and author, widely known as a founding member of Students for a Democratic Society. Here, Hayden assesses the motivation and meaning of President Obama's speech on Afghanistan and the role of the U.S. peace movement in ending the Afghan conflict.
You cannot depend on the statements of a president, not because they're liars, but because they are obligated to speak in so many directions at once to so many contrary constituencies and to shade their arguments, polish their arguments. So that's why people should be perplexed or opposed or dissatisfied. I've been working every day for 10 years on trying to end Iraq and Afghanistan, and I can say it with some confidence that we're ending the war in Afghanistan. But there's nothing positive in such a statement. It's ugly. It's unnecessary. It's bloody. There's too much suffering. Tax dollars have been wasted. But, you know, there's a way to speed up the ending or just sit back and let it play out. And I think that people that are concerned about Congress should be pushing for passage of Representative Barbara Lee's legislation to get us out of there. They should be pushing their members of Congress to sign her letter to NATO, urging a more rapid withdrawal. There are things to be done that I would put down as chores for the peace movement to perform, not like some of the great demonstrations of the past against Vietnam or Iraq. But nevertheless, pushing Obama, or if you're favorable to Obama, keeping the wind at his back are necessary part of this.
Now, a lot of people will look at what President Obama announced in Afghanistan as trying to fend off his right flank in this election year by saying we're going to stabilize the country before we pull out all support for the Afghan government. At the same time, he's trying to signal that there is an end in sight to this war, which is very unpopular with the American public. The fact that he's committed U.S. special forces to be in the country and an unspecified number of troops to remain in Afghanistan and support the Afghan government until 2024 has a lot of people concerned that this could be a quagmire that we're not going to get out of for another decade. What do you think?
It's been a quagmire for a very long time. I'm glad that the majority of people now feel the same way. Remember when many liberals in this country and Europe, feminists, were pushing for the war in Afghanistan. Once you're in, it's hell to get out, because there's so many strategic and political factors. Rather than read the tea leaves, I mean, I can discuss the speech with you. He said some very specific things that are useful. It's just a question of whether people are bystanders or they want to leave this task to somebody else or think it's going to end in its own way. I think we can make a difference by pushing for a more rapid withdrawal through the Lee legislation or other means.
What are the opportunities when the NATO summit comes to Chicago, May 20th through 22nd? You think the peace movement can revive itself after a long slumber to be out there in the streets and demand an end to the U.S. and NATO involvement in Afghanistan?
I think let's let it be and see what happens. But It doesn't have the feel of a mass unified action that it might have had. I don't think that Adbusters called to 50,000 people to come camp out in Chicago is likely to happen now that the G8 has been pulled. There may be some street battles with the Chicago police. I know all about that.
Yes, you do.
I think that would be a diversion from the main issue. But what Obama is trying to do, and I think it's very flawed, is orchestrate an image that he's ended one war in Iraq and that he's winding down the second war in Afghanistan, saving thousands of lives and trillions of tax dollars. And he's got the power of the presidential megaphone and the media, so a lot of people are going to be convinced of that. And those who think that he's blowing smoke or fabricating an illusion will have, I think, a difficult time. I admire them for trying to disprove where he's going. The way I would recommend, but who listens to me, is, you know, to unify everybody possible to demand that NATO accelerate the withdrawal from Afghanistan, period. Don't get into details. The French election guaranteed that the French troops, 3,300 troops, will be leaving by the end of this year, 2012, joining Polish troops, joining Dutch troops that have left. So NATO is really crumbling from within, because if you look at the record, this original Afghanistan rationale was to unify NATO, and I'm not making that up. That's what National Security Advisor James Jones said. Rashid Khalidi, the journalist, said that. And instead, it's become kind of a nightmare for people in Europe who are really facing austerity budgets, cuts in social programs, unemployment. The last thing they need is to inflame more people in Afghanistan against NATO by spending lives and money there. So I just think we have to push that position and see it through to the end, to the very end, which might be in 1 year, might be in 3 years.
That was Tom Hayden, a former California state senator, longtime peace and civil rights activist, best known as a co-founder of Students for a Democratic Society. Find links to Hayden's recent articles on Afghanistan and other topics on our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Even as Israeli government leaders continue to press their case for military action against Iran, targeting their nuclear capability, they continue to ignore the issue of Palestinian rights as their occupation of the West Bank is in its 45th year. In President Barack Obama's last meeting with Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu, neither man even raised the Palestinian issue. But Palestinians themselves are moving ahead with campaigns of nonviolent resistance, including prisoner hunger strikes, promotion of the boycott, divestment, and sanctions campaign, and other creative responses. During a recent convention of the United Methodist Church, delegates voted against two proposals to divest church holdings in companies which support the Israeli occupation. Even though advocates of divestment lost the debate, supporters of Palestinian rights assert that the church vote shone an important light on the issue. Currently, over 1,500 Palestinians are on hunger strike in Israeli prisons, including two who are near death, as they protest their incarceration under administrative detention without charge or trial. 10 of the jailed hunger strikers have been hospitalized after maintaining their fast for 70 days. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Mazen Kumsaya, a Palestinian-American who lived for many years in the U.S., but returned several years ago to his family home in Beit Sahor near Bethlehem in the West Bank. Kumsaya, author of Popular Resistance in Palestine, A History of Hope and Empowerment, and a leader in the popular resistance movement, was arrested last November with several other Palestinian activists after they boarded a bus bound for Jerusalem, where they legally are not allowed to travel. Here he discusses the importance of various forms of nonviolent direct action in the struggle against Israeli occupation and oppression.
Political prisoners are always center of the problem because they are the ones paying the price for these forms of resistance, sometimes also just paying a price period without any resistance, because Israel keeps, for example, hundreds of people in their prison who have not done anything and certainly have never seen a judge even. There are hundreds under administrative detention without charge, without seeing a judge. So these people become a focal point of the resistance. And popular resistance or nonviolent resistance certainly extends into the prisons. And hunger strike is a prime tool of using this method to pressure the occupiers to at least give them some decent treatment. In this case, allow family visits. Israel prevents family visits for hundreds and thousands of Palestinian prisoners regularly.
What's the status of the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement? As you know, an effort by some members of the Methodist Church to divest of some corporations involved in the occupation just failed.
Well, the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement continues to grow and is very successful, and the evidence for that is the paranoia by which Israel and its Zionist supporters around the world treat any attempt to even mild divestments or boycott attempts similar to what happened with South Africa. A latest example of this is the horrendous attack on the Methodist Church, which wanted to divest from three companies that invest in the occupation, Motorola and Caterpillar and one other company, American companies that really support the occupation. Caterpillar, for example, provided bulldozers that are specifically designed for the Israeli army against their own policies and against ethical practices and against international law. Israel uses these bulldozers to destroy Palestinian houses, to uproot olive trees, and to basically even kill residents of this area. They even used the Caterpillar to kill an American citizen. Rachel Corey, who is a 23-year-old student, went to Rafah and tried to stand in front of a bulldozer to stop the destruction of a Palestinian house. This is common practice to use these equipment made in America and paid for by our taxes, because the U.S. gives Israel billions of dollars every year, that they use American taxpayer money to pay for these things.
When you said there was a horrendous attack on supporters of divestment in the Methodist Church, what do you mean by that?
Well, there was lobbying campaigns that were done against the United Methodist Church for their even mild resolution of divestment from those three companies that invest in the illegal occupation of Palestinian land. And this pressure on the U.S. Methodists partially succeeded with some of them, but not all of them. And certainly there are at least three Methodist communities that have already divested. And there was also success in the sense that all of this education and debate and the fact that many Methodist priests and others of the church, officials of the church, were subjected to attacks, were called anti-Semites, were called names and so on. Many of these people who are attacked unfairly for standing up for human rights have become even more determined to pursue justice and human rights.
Mazen Kumsia, another example of nonviolent direct action was the Freedom Ride that you and several other Palestinians participated in late last year, boarding a bus in the West Bank headed for Jerusalem, when Palestinians are barred from such buses, and you were all arrested. Have there been any more such rides?
Well, we have been trying to come up with new ideas, and the latest ideas after the Freedom Rider bus we came up with is this Welcome to Palestine campaign you may have heard, with about 1,500 internationals try to come to Ben-Gurion Airport and declare openly that they're coming to visit us in Bethlehem, Palestinian areas. And the Israeli authorities extended their jurisdiction to European airports and demanded that airlines around the world cancel reservations, and some airlines complied with these Israeli threats and intimidation. And this actually turned out to be good for us. As I said, every time Israel and its supporters try to use intimidation and coercion, they just prove our point that this is not a democratic country as it claims to be, but it's a country of thieves and thugs, basically, and a fascist country that silences free speech. And this was shown amply by this action, and we are now planning additional actions along those lines, which expose Israeli apartheid for what it is.
That was Palestinian activist and author Mazen Kumsia. Find more information on the Palestinian Nonviolence Resistance Movement on our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The American Legislative Exchange Council, or ALEC, has come under scrutiny in recent months for its under-the-radar campaign to pass a variety of laws supported by its corporate membership in state legislatures across the U.S. One of ALEC's signature efforts was their success in 2011 in eliminating public sector labor unions' collective bargaining rights in Wisconsin, Ohio, Indiana, and Michigan. In the aftermath of the Florida shooting death of Trayvon Martin, by Neighborhood Watch volunteer George Zimmerman, ALEC's promotion of permissive stand-your-ground gun laws has been the subject of national media coverage. Widespread criticism of ALEC for its advocacy of relaxed gun laws, as well as discriminatory voter ID legislation, harsher criminal penalties for juveniles, privatization of education, and severe anti-immigration measures, has taken its toll. The negative publicity has caused prominent corporate members of ALEC, such as Coca-Cola, Pepsi, Kraft and McDonald's, to resign, and the group to disband its Elections and Public Safety Task Force. Now Common Cause, part of a national coalition of groups working to shine a spotlight on the corporate front organization's stealthy activities, has made a formal complaint to the U.S. Internal Revenue Service. Common Cause charges that ALEC is violating federal law by posing as a tax-exempt 501c3 charity, when in actuality, ALEC is spending millions of dollars lobbying for legislation benefiting its corporate membership. Your reporter spoke with Bob Edgar, president and CEO of Common Cause and a former six-term Pennsylvania congressman, who discusses his group's demand of the IRS to cancel ALEC's not-for-profit tax status, collect years of unpaid taxes, and impose necessary penalties.
About a year ago, we were given about 4,000 documents that were internal documents that the American Legislative Exchange Council had distributed over the course of many years. And what startled us in reviewing those documents was that ALEC files with the IRS as a charity. That means when a large corporation gives a large grant to this organization, they're actually getting tax relief or contributing to a charity, when more than 60% of what they do is hardcore lobbying. I spent 12 years as a member of Congress, was elected as one of the Watergate babies with Chris Dodd and Toby Moffat in 1974. I've seen lobbying up close and personal over those 12 years of service. I know what lobbying looks like, what it acts like, and what these corporations were doing. We're sneaking into resort centers a couple times a year, sitting side by side with state legislators, mostly conservative, some Democrats, mostly Republicans, and they were putting forth legislation to help their bottom line. For example, the profit-making prison industry that made for-profit prisons across the country, they got involved in ALEC in order to proliferate the immigration laws so that they could fill some of their prisons that were actually overbuilt and empty at times. The for-profit educational industry also was pushing their legislation. Where Common Cause got concerned was there were an awful lot of efforts to push back and suppress the vote, particularly of senior citizens and persons of color and poor people. So as we analyzed those documents, we decided to call out ALEC as what it is, a lobbying organization committing tax fraud. And on July 14th of last year, we gently sent a 16-page letter to the IRS, and we heard nothing from the IRS. So we discovered that there is a whistleblower law passed by Congress in 2006. We used that particular provision and filed a very formal IRS whistleblower complaint with the 4,000 documents. We hired a pro bono legal team. team from San Francisco, and they believe that the documents that we provided and the evidence that we've shared is some of the strongest whistleblower evidence that they've seen. They clearly believe that our arguments are accurate, and we believe that some of the reasons that large corporations like Coca-Cola and Pepsi and Kraft and Johnson & Johnson and some other corporations have fled ALEC is because they know if they stick with this organization, after the IRS finds them in non-compliance with the tax code, that they'll be subject to penalties and fines for actually doing lobbying work through an organization that claims zero lobbying and yet is filing as a charity under the tax code.
What are your demands from the IRS? What would you like to have the IRS do in terms of dealing with ALEC and what you believe to be a fraudulent tax status they've taken out?
Well, we would like the IRS to call out the fraud that's involved, to impose penalties and fines on ALEC, to force the organization to reorganize itself under clear provisions and exclude corporations from getting any tax deduction for charitable contributions through ALEC. The American taxpayer has been hurt over the last 30 years as corporations have found all kinds of ways to put money into politics and to corrupt the system. And we hope that the IRS will straighten this out. And if there are large fines and penalties, we want those dollars to go back to the general treasury and reimburse the federal government for the fraudulent tax provisions that have been perpetrated on the American public over the last few years.
That was Bob Edgar, President and CEO of Common Cause. Visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org to find more information on Common Cause's IRS complaint against ALEC for tax code violations and related stories. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by writing us at mail@btlonline.org. Visit our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Richard Hill, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.